Good morning, and welcome to the American Security Project. We are a nonpartisan think tank examining some of the big strategic issues facing our nation. And one of those is counterterrorism and how we face Al Qaeda and the morphing of Al Qaeda going forward. Today we've got three experts on the subject. First, we've got Syed Tamsamani. He's a senior fellow at the Meridian International Center. He was previously a senior political advisor to the US Embassy in Rabat, Morocco from 1992 to 2011. He's a regular commentator on international politics on Al Jazeera, and he writes regularly on Middle East Online, FoxNews.com, Eurasia Review, Albany Tribune, and many others. In the middle, we have Zach Gold. He is an accomplished researcher and writer on U.S. Middle East policy, specifically concerning threats to the Egyptian and regional security from Sinai and Gaza. He is the author of a recent analysis paper on Sinai terrorism and security cooperation for the Brookings Institution, Sabah Center for Middle East Policy, and the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague. We have Timothy Furbank. He is the co-founder and managing director of Development Transformations, an organization focusing on development and governance programs in countries undergoing conflict, post-conflict, or political transition. DT works in several countries in the Middle East and North Africa, including Yemen. He travels to Yemen regularly, where he manages DT's research assessments, governance, and civil society development programs in support of Yemen's political transitions. And I think you've just returned recently. So first of all, we'll hear from Syed, who's going to talk about what's going on in Morocco.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, for having me today with this distinguished panel. And I'm very interested to talk about a topic of a great interest, not only to Morocco, not only to the Arabs, but to the whole world, because we are talking about a common threat that is terrorism and extremism. Just a mere coincidence, when Paul called me the first time and asked me to be in this panel weeks ago, I was watching Moroccan TV, and they had two separate TV shows about this particular topic of the Moroccan fighters going to Syria. In Morocco, we all believe that the number of these fighters is something like 100, even 200. But then I was surprised, like the rest of the people who are participating in the TV shows or those who are watching those TV shows, to hear that the number is more than that. We are talking about 1,000, maybe 2,000 Moroccan fighters in Syria, calling themselves jihadist. So the first question that came to my mind is why and how they can do that. So, you know, to have that number of these Moroccan fighters in Syria. Logistically, it's easy. It's not expensive, and Moroccans can go to through Turkey. And visa is not required for them. And of course, when they get there, automatically they are taken to bordering towns and cities to Syria, where they receive training, so combat training, and of course, indoctrination for the jihadi Salafi doctrine. Because the thing is, like, at the beginning, many of those who went to Syria when the atrocities of the Syrian regime started. The people who went there were like people who spent time in jail, service sentence in jail right after those who were accused of 2003, May 16, 2003 bombings in Casablanca. As you know, many of the Salafist members who are either involved or supported those acts that were perpetrated in Morocco in 2003 were arrested under a law called the anti-terrorism law that was passed in 2003. So those who were released, of course, it was hard for them to be integrated. They found that they were watching closely by the authorities, and for that they were looking for another place, environment, to go. And of course, this is, I mean, for them, some of them went to Iraq. Some of them were able to go down to even to Mali, but the numbers were not that big compared to what we're talking about today. When we say that the number has reached something like more than 1,000, something we're talking about to 2,000. Ideologically, Syria is a good argument for the recruiters. In the Salafi jihadi doctrine, it is said that Syria was referred to as a sham. It's going to be a decisive battle between the Muslims and the non-believers. So this is the adequate place for those who are seeking a place in heaven, and the way for them is to join massively the jihad. So we have two groups. We have groups who served a sentence after the May 16 bombings 2003, and those who are not Salafist. Because when I was watching this TV show and they were interviewing some of the members of the families, the members of the family said they were shocked and surprised to see that they never know that their kids were, you know, taking any Salafist ideology or doctrine. Of course, they went to mosque, they do their prayers regularly and so on. And some of these people were married. So they left their kids, families, and they decided to join the war, what they call the jihad, the holy war in Syria. So the thing is, we have two different groups of the Moroccans who originally leave from Morocco. And then we talk about others, Moroccans, who live mostly in Europe, who were born in Europe. So we're talking about the second, third, and fourth generation, Spain, France, Belgium, Netherlands, who decided themselves to go and join. That's why the number was growing. I think it's very hard for us to know the exact number, because it's only when these people die, then, you know, we hear names. But usually the things like they're using pseudonyms. And they add to it the name Al-Maghribi, which means Moroccans. You hear Abu Sam Al-Maghribi, for example. And then that means somebody from Morocco, but the name would be Ahmed or whatever common name. But original, most of the people are, and this is a study, a research that was done by some Moroccan expert, were from the north of Morocco, from Tangier, from Tetouan, and even from, and now from big cities like Casablanca and Fez. The thing is, like, money, we're talking about something like 8,000 dirhams, which is like $900 for the whole trip. So it's not that expensive for them to go and join those groups. And then there are benefactors who provide money either for them to travel, and even when they're away, some of those benefactors provide their families with money. Mostly the Moroccans, when they decided to go to Syria, they joined a group called the ISIS, the Islamic State for Iraq and the Sham. But they're not, they have never reached the level of the commanders. Most of them are like foot soldiers. It's only when a guy by the name of Brahim Ben Shakroun, who was a former Guantanamo detainee, went to Syria in 2012, was able to recruit a great number of Moroccans, young Moroccans, to join, and they form a group called Harakat Sham in Harakat Islam in Sham. So they have their own little group. So the first time that we have a group of Moroccans, like 700, maybe 800, forming their own group and not joining others, like there are others who joined, like the ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, and other existing groups in Syria. Brahim Ben Shokroun, who was killed recently, so maybe we said maybe they would have an impact on this process of recruitment from potential fighters from Morocco. So according to a French researcher, Romain Caillé, who lives in Lebanon, who follows this group of Salafism, he said that the big question that we have is a lot of those who went to Syria were kind of disappointed because they say that they only on the ground they found themselves that they are fighting for a cause that it's not their own. So they wanted to go back home, they wanted to go back to Morocco. Of course, the authorities, that's another issue for them. How could they allow these groups to come back after receiving combat training and ideology? It's the same case not only for Morocco, for all those who have their own citizens in Syria fighting with those groups. So Morocco had to find a strategy to fight, or at least not to fight, but at least to counter these Salafist jihadist doctrine or ideology. And so far, they've been very, very successful. 2004, there were religious reforms that allowed Morocco to kind of revive what we call a brand of Islam in Morocco. They call it the Moroccan Islam. It's Maliki Sufi Islam, allowing for what they call the training of imams, men and women. So for the first time we have in the Muslim world women as preachers. That way they can talk directly to other women in mosque. They're not leading prayers, of course, but it's like only when they are talking, answering questions and issues of that women could raise. And then there are a group of imams that received a 1 year training. Others can go, you know, to the high school of theology called Dar al-Hadith al-Hassaniyah in Rabat, where they, after year graduate studies, they become scholars. This first strategy was very, very successful because we start seeing a revival of the Moroccan Islam to the point now that we have that in Morocco, countries like Tunisia, Libya, Mali, even Cote d'Ivoire, and even recently Nigeria, after this incident with the Boko Haram, they asked and requested officially Morocco to provide training for their own imams. And of course, Morocco answered that request. And now they are like, because the number is growing, Morocco decided to build another school of training for those potential imams. And the other thing is Morocco, again, is doing is providing with collaboration with the European government, where the Moroccans massively reside, is to provide countries like Spain, France, Belgium, Netherlands, with Moroccan public preachers and scholars, so that they could, in a way, answer issues, religious issues of concern to the Moroccans residing there, in a way indirectly help in sharing that Moroccan strategy of countering extremism in Europe. So now the big question we have in Morocco right now, as I said earlier, and the rest of the of other countries, is that the families of those combatants in Syria are pressing the Moroccan government to allow them to come back home. Of course, some of them came back, automatically they are put in jail. So there are others who are afraid to come back, because for them it's like there's no way out. It's either they stay in Syria and they are killed, or they go back home and they are put in jail. Well, the Moroccan authorities' answer is logical and clear in that. They say, how could we trust those people who spent time in receiving this combatant training, know how to handle weapons and explosives, and receiving this extremist ideology to come back home, and who knows what they're going to do. How would they be able to perpetrate terrorist acts inside their own country? Of course, the thing is, like, some of them, when you're looking online, we're saying, well, that's not in the discourse of these of these groups. But Morocco went through tough times, you know, in 2003, 2007, 2011, where terrorist acts were perpetrated in Casablanca, and 2011 in Marrakech, and many people died. And it was mostly by people who were in Afghanistan, or at least those who were, you know, some of them who were in Guantanamo and came back and were able to mobilize a number of young Moroccans to perpetrate those acts. So now it's like Morocco has developed, at least now, if we look at the Arab world, I would say, I would limit it to the North Africa, I would say that Morocco developed this new strategy, this new, with through these religious reforms, to be able to counter this dangerous phenomenon. Has it been successful? So far, I would say yes. Otherwise, other countries would not have asked for Morocco's help to face their own this own phenomenon in their own country. So now in Morocco, there's a new term that we're talking about, spiritual diplomacy. And that is like, you know, Morocco, you know, like a recent trip made by the King Mohammed VI to West Africa, you know, making sure that, you know, that not, it was very symbolic in handing out copies of the Quran to the religious scholars and the Ministry of Islamic Affairs of those countries. But the most important part of it is the agreement or the convention that was signed is providing training for imams of those countries. So now, from Mali, Morocco started receiving, the number was 500, so start receiving, now they have 100 imams from Mali who are receiving the training. Others will come later to join their counterparts in Morocco. And then gradually others will benefit from that training. So I think I will stop here, and I will be happy to answer your questions later if you have any, of course, if you have any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll move on to Egypt and Zach.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Saeed, for that excellent, informative presentation. It saves me some thoughts on Syria, certainly. Again, my name is Zach Gold, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about the internal dynamics that are taking place in Egypt now and their effect broadly on regional security and also U.S. policy towards that. I'm actually going to talk about the threat that's happening right now, how Egypt is responding to that, what the U.S. strategic interests are in terms of counterterrorism in Egypt, and then also U.S. assistance. We've seen since the Egyptian revolution in January of 2011, a large increase in radical Islamic terrorism. I don't use the term al-Qaeda because certainly this is debatable, or it is debated, but there is no al-Qaeda in Egypt. And so I talk about al-Qaeda inspired groups, perhaps some al-Qaeda aspirational groups, and radical Salafi jihadi groups that are doing al-Qaeda type work, whether or not they're aligned with al-Qaeda. I think the biggest thing to think about is where the threat originally came from. If we look back to January of 2011, I focus a lot on the Sinai. One area that Egypt has been focusing on for the past couple of years is also the Libyan border, but I'll be talking primarily about Sinai today. One thing that we saw in Sinai in January of 2011 was that the security forces as they did throughout the country, disappeared. This was an action that created chaos. It created chaos in mainland Egypt, and more importantly, it created chaos in Sinai, where for the past 5 years, and perhaps for even longer, the tribal Bedouin population and also the Palestinian populations in the cities in North Sinai had been very harshly repressed by the state. This came after al-Qaeda-type bombings from 2004 to 2006, and actually Egypt was able to, in the short term, solve that problem by cracking down harshly on the Sinai. So in 2011, when the security forces disappeared, the local population took a method of retribution, which involved basically sacking every single police station and police checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula, including firing RPGs at police stations in major cities. Another issue that created the original problem that actually Saeed mentioned was releasees from prison and also escapees from prison. Many of you may remember that in January 2011, a number of prison breaks took place in Egypt, during which a number of hardened jihadis did escape, and reportedly some went to Sinai to take refuge. Finally, from the Egyptian, other side of Egypt, there was an outlay of, an after effect, of the Libyan revolution in Egypt. In what happened, we saw that when the Libyans rose up, they started taking over Gaddafi's weapons storehouses. And these were advanced weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons, including anti-tank weapons, that started flooding into Sinai on their way to Gaza. Sinai has long been a location, a nexus of trafficking, both in weapons and in drugs and in humans. And so a lot of new connections were made, and instead of weapons for Gaza being smuggling up from Sudan, there's an entirely new source. So the threat that we've seen mostly is, if I can just give you some numbers, according to a press release from the Egyptian government last month, I guess at the end of April, about 700 Egyptians have been killed, primarily police officers and soldiers, since the January 2011 uprising. 500 of those have been killed since the coup last summer. So we see a clear increase after the events of last summer in Egypt as well. Most of these attacks are small. It is roadside bombs in Sinai. It is the targeting of a police officer or police checkpoint in Cairo. Most of these attacks are not claimed by anyone. It is really only the large, spectacular attacks for which anyone takes credit or claims responsibility, and when that is done, it's by a group called Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, or Supporters of Jerusalem. Ansar Beit al-Maqdis was founded in 2011 by Egyptians. It's clear that some of them have connections to Gaza, either in that they originally trained in Gaza, or they receive inspiration from a fellow group in Gaza. But they are Egyptians, and they are Egyptian-focused. The group actually, as its name suggests, Supporters of Jerusalem, its original attacks were focused on attacking Israel and attacking the Egyptian-Israeli relationship, which includes the pipeline, the border, trying to interrupt and interfere in Egyptian-Israeli relations. Following the coup in July, the group almost entirely switched its tactics its targets towards Egypt itself. And has claimed in statements that is carrying out economic warfare against the Egyptian military specifically. Thanks, Syed, for mentioning Syria, so I don't have to go deep into it. Actually, it's very interesting to note that the number of Egyptians, although Egypt is a country of almost 90 million people, the number of Egyptians fighting in Syria is significantly smaller than even the number of Moroccans. And overall, there's a small amount of Egyptians that go to fight in Syria for many of the same reasons that Saeed mentioned. However, I've seen numbers, I heard from U.S. government sources that it is fewer than 100. I've heard from other people around 300 Egyptians have gone to fight in Syria. And we have seen a number of Ansar Beit al-Maqdis tied individuals who have returned from Syria and carried out attacks in Egypt, including in September of 2013, the former Egyptian officer who attempted to kill the Minister of Interior had reportedly fought in Syria prior to that. One reason that people say that there is al-Qaeda in Egypt is because they talk about individuals who are affiliated to leaders of al-Qaeda for whom it's unclear where they've gone and what they've done. For example, in the summer of 2011, there was a report that Ramzi al-Muwafi, who had escaped from prison in January of 2011, was in Al-Arish in Sinai organizing jihadis and organizing members of a group that used to be called Takfir wal-Jihad. Ramzi Muwafi was known, according to the CNN headline, as bin Laden's doctor. He was very close to Osama bin Laden and fought with him in Afghanistan. He escaped from prison during January of 2011. Another individual is Ahmed Salama Mabruk, who was released from prison on Ministry of Interior orders under Mohamed Morsi in the fall of 2012. Again, it's unclear where he went, although it's said by some reports that he went to Sinai and was organizing fighters. Mabruk was actually very close to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of al-Qaeda. They were leaders of the Islamic Jihad in Egypt together. Mabruk spent time in Guantanamo prison, and in January 2011, when there were these massive prison breaks, his presence was of serious concern to U.S. authorities. And finally, there's Muhammad Jamal, who ran the Muhammad Jamal Network. Very nice to name things after yourself. Muhammad Jamal, as many of us might have heard, was possibly or reportedly, and his fighters were involved in the 2012 Benghazi attack on a U.S. Mission there. And he was arrested. He was released from prison sometime in spring of 2011 by the then leading authorities, the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces. He was living freely in Egypt, actually studying for a master's degree, while at the same time making connections to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, as well as sending letters to Ayman al-Zawahiri, asking for funds and talking about the things he was doing. Again, he was arrested 2 years ago, and last fall he was added to the U.S. Special Designated Terrorist Group. I wanted to, when talking about Mohammed Jamal, just quickly mention Libya. Again, my focus is, and the focus of this presentation is on Sinai. However, Libya has been a concern, and I know that, at least in the press, it's being put as a new concern, but it's not. When I was speaking with Egyptian military officials almost 2 years ago, they were discussing the Libya weapons flow and Libyan fighters and Libyan border issue. So this is something that President-elect al-Sisi has mentioned regularly in interviews, but the chaos that we've seen in Libya, there's serious concern in Egypt that that will filter over. And we've also seen, of course, as I mentioned, these weapons flows that have happened. The Egyptian response has been quite interesting because Saeed mentioned that there were policy changes, these attempts for the religious institutions to sort of counter radical extremism. That is happening to a small extent in Egypt, but primarily the Egyptians are countering their terrorism threat the same way they countered them a decade ago, with brute force and repression. This is actually working. In the short term, we have seen the number of attacks from Sinai decrease. There has not been a claimed attack outside of Sinai by Ansar Beit al-Maqdis since January, and the group itself has not claimed any attacks, I believe, since March. There have also been a number of its leaders reportedly killed in various incidents. Again, though, this, in my mind, is a short-term measure. As we saw in January of 2011, any small event can create a spark that leads to a bursting out of terrorism and violence. And especially if we've seen Egypt, which is a very, or Sinai, which is a very tribal society, there are a lot of feelings and, of course, even tribal laws about retribution and retaliation. And so in addition to going after those who are a real threat, Egypt is also, in a way, creating new enemies. The U.S., of course, plays a role in this. The U.S. has many strategic interests in Egypt, but on the, in the sense of counterterrorism, it has two. One is that Egypt continues to fight terrorism and take counterterrorism actions. That's the main one that we always talk about. We say U.S. has an interest in Egyptian counterterrorism. Another strategic interest we have, however, is that Egypt does not create more terrorism, that Egyptians' policy actions and military actions don't create a further radicalization, which then comes back to haunt both Egypt and the United States. So far, all of the attacks that we've seen in Egypt are focused on Egyptian interests. And though, even though there have been attacks on shipping in the Suez Canal to a very small extent, and there was one attack on tourists, it was basically assessed that those attacks were not necessarily on Western interests, but more, again, on this economic warfare against the Egyptian state. The Sinai Canal brings in more than $5 billion to the Egyptian GDP, and tourism, when tourists were coming, was closely the same. So these are part of economic warfare to try to get shipping to not go through the Suez Canal or to try to get visitors to stop coming to Egypt. So what we've seen is the U.S. cooperating to a large extent on Sinai counterterrorism and on border security. This is included in fiscal year 2012. We provided about $150 million to the Egyptians for border security, border monitors, helicopters to monitor the Libyan and Sudanese borders, also checkpoints for those borders. And these have been major issues that the U.S. has focused on. Now, when I spoke with the American Security Project last month, I mentioned that it was likely that the U.S. will continue to work on border counterterrorism, border protection, and Sinai counterterrorism while not really looking in, while not helping out in domestic events, political terrorism inside the mainland. I thought that what the Egyptians were, the methods by which the Egyptian government, the interim government, had been cracking down on political dissent would make it difficult for the U.S. to cooperate in that crackdown. What we have seen since is that not only has that crackdown affected U.S. cooperation on local political terror groups, but it has also affected cooperation on border security and counterterrorism. It was reported just the other day that 10 Apache helicopters, which had been released 6 weeks ago, have still been held up. And this is because there has been a lot of concern in Congress about the Egyptian government's political repression, and it appears that the Obama administration did not want to ruffle feathers of the congressional appropriators, even though no congressional approval is necessary for releasing those helicopters. I'll just finish really quickly by mentioning that there was just an Egyptian presidential election, and President-elect Sisi won a 95% of the votes. He has a clear mandate. His mandate and his campaign have been very much, I will do what is necessary. And there's been no hint from his statements, from his campaign platform, brief as it was, that what was necessary was going to be a political, a policy change, but very much a security-focused military approach to countering terrorism. And again, this is a concern I have moving forward, both in terms of U.S. cooperation and in terms of building and creating long-term terror threats. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. And we'll move on to Tim in Yemen.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. It's always, I think, a little bit easier to go last because you can play off the other two. And thanks for your comments. Before I jump into Yemen and al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula specifically, I thought it'd be useful to sort of lay the groundwork of where we are in Yemen right now. And I'd argue that AQAP is, while internationally and from sort of the perspective that we have, might be the single thing we think about when we think about Yemen. Through my trips, and I've been too many times, maybe 7 or 8 times, but extensive meetings, it's very low on the agenda of the current Yemeni individual. When you're in 4, 5, 6 hour COT sessions with them, AQAP doesn't come up unless you really, really try to squeeze it out of them. Yemen right now recently had a sort of major fighting in the north between the Houthis and the Salafis. The Houthi movement in the north is spreading into Sana'a. You have other issues such as what is you know, a U.S. internationally backed interim government led by President Hadi that is doing a good job. And I'll get to the current recent offensive in the south by the Yemen armed forces. The cabinet's slightly weak. You have members of parliament who actually don't have terms. Everyone's sort of acting or sort of pending status. So you have no elected official with that much of a mandate. In the south, you have a lot of issues. You have, we do have a QAP, but there's the powerful Islah movement, the Muslim Brotherhood affiliated movement. There's the Harak separatist movement, which is, I don't know if it's growing in strength, but it still has very powerful individuals, those that want to break off and create a North and South Yemen. So AQAP sort of falls in line with all these things that are happening. And so from our perspective, it's easy to think of this as the number one challenge they have. And also going back, I think if we went back to 2009, 2010, the increase in U.S. counterterrorism attention in Europe and U.S. counterterrorism CT policy, both by the U.S. and Yemen, the more that is increased, you can also look at and see a parallel increase in the number of AQAP members, supporters, or sympathizers. So I will say, so that's sort of my introduction. And I mean, like all transnational jihadi movements, AQAP is in the constant state of flux. Right now, over the last month or two, there's been a quite impressive offensive in the south, mainly in Shabwa and Abyan, first by the US and then by the Yemen armed forces, and has killed a large number of AQAP members and supporters. There have been some retaliations against the Yemeni civilians, Yemeni military members. But so far, I think the future of AQAP in Yemen rests on what happens right now, what happens in the weeks to come, and what happens following that. Now, this offensive right now that President Hadi and his generals are leading that's quite admirable and been successful so far. I think there has been a similar attack happened in 2012, or a similar approach, where the Yemeni government went pretty hard at AQAP, and not quite this hard. But what we saw at that time was, instead of just sort of backing off, what AQAP did at the time was they went into hiding for a little bit. And actually, what happened is they went from sort of one region or two regions to they split off and kind of regrouped, went underground, and instead of holding particular territories, instead of actually owning and running towns, almost Taliban style, in places like Shabwa, they moved out and expanded into other parts of the country. And so what will be interesting to see is if after this current offensive, or during this current offensive, will AQAP simply weaken? Will they be able to gain supporters or sympathizers? Or will they sort of go and get quiet for a while, move into other territories, and come back in 6 months or a year at the same size, or maybe even a stronger presence? Also recently we found, I think, a lot of, unfortunately, supporters have joined AQAP from Saudi. I think in the last 3-4 months, Yemeni sources, military sources have said that approximately 500 Saudi citizens have crossed the border to join AQAP. Recently in Shabwa, during the military offensive, you could see that a lot of people have been paid by in Saudi currency. So this is not just a local problem, but it is being influenced by the kingdom, by individuals living in Saudi Arabia, not the government. I didn't mean to suggest that at all. Interesting. We always think that from the U.S. perspective or the kind of the CT threat, it's always the threat on the homeland. And recently there has been no threat against the United States. And I think a lot of Yemeni citizens view, even though I started this by saying that it's not, AQAP is not the top of their list or their biggest worry, they see it more of a threat against Yemeni citizens. I think back in the days when bin Laden was alive and you had more of sort of a single stronger al-Qaeda, now we're dealing with multiple al-Qaedas, and you have what right now is you have AQAP going after Yemeni targets, you have non-Muslim targets, and that itself is a big change. The attack not too long ago against the hospital, the Yemeni Ministry of Defense in Sana'a was something that was quite unexpected and perhaps was one thing that got the Yemeni people more and more against AQAP. That also leads into the public relations efforts by AQAP, which are actually quite impressive, for they immediately went out and apologized. Apologize for the innocent victims, but also their way of saying why they attacked the Ministry of Defense was that so many of the people in the Ministry of Defense were aligned with the Houthi movement, and so that PR that they've been doing has been, many argue, quite effective. And going forward, it'll be interesting to see what develops after this, the Yemeni Armed Forces offensive, and what happens after that. Sort of closing, and I talked about the increase in counterterrorism efforts, the increase in drone strikes, the increase in efforts to root out AQAP, whether by the Yemeni government or the U.S. government. And of course, there's more statistical data here. But it has led, but it's coincided with a growth, an increase in the size, presence, and influence of AQAP in Yemen, which is something to think about. And at the end of the day, you have members of the military making about $160 a year, $160 a month. You have an incredibly poor economy. You have a lot of things where hearts and minds are tough to capture when people aren't getting paid, when IMF negotiations are sort of following through or aren't getting done in time, when the government isn't as strong as it could be, when the former president is interfering. All of these things continue to weaken the state, and as long as you have the weak state, as long as the people either don't support a common government or don't support sort of a common leader or their local governments or local council, that is where groups such as AQAP can easily fit in. That's where groups can make a mark, make a difference. So the weaker the state, the better the chance AQAP has to infiltrate and to increase and to become more of a presence.
Thank you so much. Three very different problems, different approaches, but clearly connected. We've got some time for Q&A. If you'd like to raise your hand and then tell me who you are and where you're from, and then a quick question to this gentleman at the front.
I'm Mohammed Elabiari from Dallas, Texas, Lone Star Intelligence. Thank you very much, Paul, great panel. So for Saeed, I had a question about Morocco. You spoke about Moroccan Islam. Is there room in Moroccan Islam, even though it's Sufi, for, I guess, a visible Salafi movement, as opposed to the covert expansion of the Salafiyya Gehdaya movement that you were mentioning? Is there any discussion amongst the Moroccan government to allow for an above-board Salafi presence in the society, which would obviously allow for more intel and tracking and that kind of stuff? For Zach, I had one question about Egypt, because it's obviously close to my heart. Been attacked a lot over the past year and a half because of MB influence in the Obama administration, because I advise it. What do you see, or do you see something that you think that we can, as civil society in the U.S., actually help the Egyptian officials, their security officials, think more strategically about not growing that radicalization wave moving forward? And Tim, thank you very much. Also, I don't technically have a question for you, but you know, I appreciate it anyway. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for your excellent question. As you know, the Moroccans, and as you know, Moroccans in general, we have no problem with the thought of the Salafist. As long as we're talking about the Salaf Saleh. So that means like going back to the path of real Islam, the time of the Prophet. To answer quickly your question, there's an event that occurred in Morocco. One of the Salafist, very famous Salafist kind of spiritual leader, who was sentenced to 30 years of prison back in 2003. Because of a controversial interview that he gave to Sheikh al-Awsat, where he was encouraging and inciting, right after the May bombings in 2003 in Casablanca, where he was inciting young Moroccans, what he called real Muslim, to go after Moroccan government institutions. And he was sentenced for 30 years. In 2011, he benefited from what we call the royal pardon, and he was released after serving 7 years in prison. That guy, by name of Mohamed Fizazi, in one of the recent trips that the king made to Tangier, and as you know, the king, in his capacity as a commander of the faithful, he went to the Friday prayers in Tangier, and to the big surprise, not only of the Moroccans, but international public opinion, because of those who are following closely Morocco, the Friday prayers were led by Mohamed Fizazi. So the king attended the Friday sermon in the presence of Mohamed Fizazi, who delivered a very interesting sermon, Friday sermon, where he explained his revision of his thought, of his perception of Islam, where he was admitting that he was wrong and that the time he served in prison gave him this time and capacity to review his thought, and he was asking other young Moroccans who are, you know, close to Salafi thought to review their thought and concerns. So that image of the king attending prayers, Friday prayers, in the presence of that particular person who is, as I know, as I told you, one of the spiritual leaders of the Salafi doctrine in Morocco, give a very strong signal example of how Moroccans can accept Salafi, but not the Salafiyya Jihadiyya. Others, very quickly, others who served a prison known to be very, again, spiritual leaders, now we see them on TV all the time. They're participating in conferences. Now there's a guy by the name Abu Hafs now working for a radio TV, a radio station in Casablanca, where he give, lectures. But when you're listening to the guy, you see that guy has completely reviewed his thought, and now he's talking about more of a tolerant Islam, giving his views of Salafi, but based on a tolerance, coexistence, and accepting of the others.
Thank you. That's a great question. I think, actually, the Egyptian military at least rhetorically, recognizes that it can't blast its way out of the problem. When I was speaking with Egyptian military leaders a year and a half ago, they were saying to me, boy, the Ministry of Interior, which used to be in charge of Sinai, boy, the Ministry of Interior really screwed up by causing a lot of problems for the local population. But we, the military, understand that differently, and we are loved by the local population. While they are certainly loved more than the Interior Ministry and the police, they're now creating a lot of problems and almost reliving the problems that the MOI created a decade ago. I would say that, again, it's recognized, and I know that the Egyptian Foreign Ministry and the Egyptian Embassy reports back to their government and to the military and saying, hey, America's really upset about this, and the government thinks you're going in the wrong direction. I think, from my perception, the military will say to them, well, do better. I think that as groups, perhaps, of Egyptian Americans can help to make the point back home that, no, this really is a point of contention between the two countries. I also think that in terms of teaching valuable lessons, that there could be groups, perhaps, of veterans or military planners who fought in western Iraq with the Sahwa movement, you know, how you needed to really get the cooperation of the local population and not just kill a large number of people. And ultimately, I think that if the Egyptian military is using weapons in a way that is counterproductive to U.S. strategic interests, then ultimately the only thing the U.S. can do is withhold those weapons. Now, obviously, we don't want to get to a point where that there's a strategic break in that sense, but that's sort of where we're going. And we've seen, actually, al-Qaeda creating a narrative. Adam Gadan's last statement was, hey, supporters, the U.S. is backing the Egyptian military's killing of Muslims in your country. And that's a narrative that the U.S. does not want to be part of simply because, to this point, there have not been attacks on the U.S. or Western targets in Egypt. And we'd very much like to keep it that way.
Thank you. We'll get you a question next. There's a lady here.
Rebecca Cataldi from the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, and I did have a question on Yemen. You mentioned the possibility that after this latest military offensive that the al-Qaeda AQIP groups could sort of diffuse again to other parts of the country but ultimately come back and start to rebuild and retake territory in the south in places like Abyan and Shabwa, which is, of course, is exactly what we saw after the 2012 offensive. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what do you think it is that makes that area in the south, particularly Abyan and Shabwa, so attractive to them? Or is there something that makes it particularly attractive? Or do you think if they're sort of forced to withdraw again that they might regroup and sort of rebuild stronger bases elsewhere in the country? And secondly, I had a question on Morocco. Would you be able to speak a little bit more about the imam training program you mentioned that had been fairly successful in CV, sort of what is their methodology or what's made it different from other programs? Thank you.
Thanks for your question. I think those two places will always be their strongest areas. Going back to the 90s after reunification, a lot of this movement started with those coming back from Afghanistan. And some analysts would argue that sort of post-reunification, the previous president and one of his powerful allies, one of the generals, really sought to have some sort of established relationship and cooperation with this growing AQ movement, just because it did offset some of the stronger secular political movements in the South. That all changed after the USS Cole bombings. But that's where they were in the past. That's where they've been able to have a stronger foothold. Really, the only other areas, I think, and Al-Bayd is one area where they could easily, where there already is a presence, and where one could expect probably military interaction in the months to come. Last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, AQAP tried to rob a bank in Hadramaut. After the UNSC Security Council resolution that really stopped foreign countries being able to pay pay ransoms for kidnappings. A lot of their funding has gone down, and so robbing banks and whatnot is one of the tactics they're using now. But Hadhramaut is another potential area, but the Hadhrami people have always been quite independent. You've seen the HCC, the Hadhramaut Tribal Confederate. So there is an emerging sort of independent movement within Hadhramaut that it leaves a lot of area for AQAP to move into, but Hadhramaut takes up such a big part of the country, maybe a third of the country, that it doesn't leave many other areas for AQAP to grow in. There are some cells in Sana'a, but they're quite small.
For the school of imams training in Morocco, it is for both for men and women. The time when they started, and I, by coincidence, I attended the inauguration of the school, the first school of imams, there were about 150, and it was only the number between men and women was equal. The thing, the most important thing about the school of imam is that not necessarily only select those who only study like theology or those who are like in Quranic schools. These are students who have their BAs in different fields, can be from humanities to science, and who decide, and because of their thought for Islam that they would like to become imams, so they receive a one-year training, which is not only of Islam as a religion, but other components as well. So it could be computer science, it can be marketing, it could be economics, it could be international relations, plus a component about religions, interreligious programs, meaning that they have to study about Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. So then this group, after 1 year of training, they'll graduate, you know, those are imam, and for the women, they're called murshidat. And the murshidat are allowed to go to the mosque to talk to other women and do other activities, like social activities and so on, for the women in a whatever neighborhood they're assigned to. Now, the school of imams, they start receiving imams from other countries, as I said in my first presentation, about, you know, from first group now would come from Mali, others would come from Tunisia, Libya, Guinea, Cote d'Ivoire, and recently we heard even from Nigeria. Very quickly, there is another school that is school, the graduate studies for School of Theology, which is totally different. Those for those who want to become scholars, because in Morocco we have what we call the Higher Council of Religious Scholars, and in those and I think the best of my knowledge, in that Higher Council of Religious Scholars, we call it the ulama, where we have women members of that Higher Council as well. And I don't know whether there's any other country in a Muslim country would have like a senior level where we have women sitting in that council as well.
Unfortunately, it's 9:30 and we've actually run out of time. But we will be taking forward these types of discussions going forward. And next week we have a great presentation on the Arab Youth Survey. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank the panelists, and please give them a round of applause.